This is the Shelley Irwin Show podcast from WGVU for Thursday, June 4, 2026. Today, Taste of Muskegon. Dr. Randall Maurice Jelks on his book, My America, the Women's Resource Center, foster parent Laura Boonstra, and Dr. Evan Dellen on esophagitis. That's all coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast from WGVU.
Ready, Muskegon, for Taste of Muskegon. It happens. It returns to Hackley Park June 12th through 13th this year. The festival is putting even more heart in the experience. I'm not sure that can happen. It's had a pretty good heart. Let's turn to you, Lisa Krause, marketing manager, about the details. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning.
Right. All right. Putting more heart. Let's get into the conversation. Good food, doing good things for Muskegon. Talk to me about the tradition of Taste of Muskegon.
Yeah. So Taste of Muskegon has always brought the community together because, you know, what brings people together better than food? And we have, you know, about 30 local food trucks and restaurants line the streets and free concerts. We've got kids area. We've got all sorts of fun things, but we thought, this is our 20th anniversary. We should do something a little extra. So this year we're also focusing on we're also going to focus on those who don't have enough to eat, which is something we're really excited about this year.
Let's do the 101s. This is, what shall we say, a two-day event?
Yes. Yep. It's because we party really hard that first day, so I think it gets full credit. It's 4:30 to 10 on Friday, and 11 to 10 on Saturday.
And how does it work in general when I say I'm headed over to Taste of Muskegon? Bring my wallet and bring my family?
Yes. Don't bring your pets, but bring your wallet and your family and be ready to have, and come hungry. Please come very hungry. So it's free to get in. You'll buy taste tickets when you get there. A ticket is $1, and all the taste-sized portions are 1 to 5 tickets. If you really like something and you want to eat a full version of it, it will be more. But if you want to eat as much as you possibly can and sample your way around Muskegon, you're just going to buy those taste tickets and try little bits of everything from everyone. If you can get through all 30, more power to you, but get as far as you can through those. The music is free. There is a charge for the kids' bounce houses, but we do have the Critter Barn coming. We have a yoga session. So we got other things for kids to do that's also free. There's a lot of opportunity to just experience the park in whatever way you want.
What is new in 2026? I'll begin with the Eat More, Feed More.
Yes. So we are, like I said, for 20 years, we wanted to go big. Last year, we partnered with Kids Food Basket and AgeWell Services to feed the young and the older members of our community. And we were able to give them $5,000 checks each. And we thought, we can do better than this for 20 years. Let's raise $20,000. That's equivalent to 4,000 meals that we want to provide for our community. So you can donate now right on the website, or you can, when you come to the park, we'll have Kids Food Basket there. We'll have AgeWell there, and you can donate directly with them. They're going to have bags that you can decorate to send home those sack suppers from Kids Food Basket. And we've heard a lot of stories that those kids actually hang those pictures that you draw on those bags on their walls, because sometimes it's the only art they have in their life, and that's really important to them. We're also going to send love to the seniors by coloring on placemats and delivering their meals with that extra bit of love too. If you have extra tickets in your pocket at the end of the night that you haven't spent, we've all had that, right? I was just at the food truck rally at the farmers market last night, walked out with extra tickets in my pocket. When you're like, I don't have any more room to eat, we'll have buckets for you to stick those in and donate those to pass food forward to those in our community that don't eat, which Muskegon County has a huge population of food insecure. And if we can, you know, do our part to make a dent in that, we're going to be proud of it.
Thank you. Lisa Krause, again, marketing manager, Taste of Muskegon, happening not this weekend, but next, June 12th through 13th. Tell me about the student connection.
Yeah, so we've teamed up with the Muskegon Career Tech Center, which is a facility that works with high school students. As part of their high school classes, they get to go spend from various high schools, multiple high schools in Muskegon County participate. And they send their students to learn trades. And one of those is culinary. And their culinary students are, even though they're out of class, this is not giving them even class credit. They're doing it because they love what they've learned. They're going to jump in the food trucks, trailers, and behind the booths of our local restaurants at Taste of Muskegon to get some hands-on experience cooking with the chef. This is the first year of the project. We've had the Culinary Institute students from Baker before, and we're hoping to snag a couple of them yet this year. But going forward, we're hoping next year to start the partnership earlier and get the students actually in on the planning of Taste of Muskegon, working with us on logistics and marketing and all those pieces so that these high schoolers come out knowing how to organize the whole event. So we're really excited about that partnership and introducing these students to people that they're going to be rubbing shoulders with in the future.
Very cool. Lisa, lastly, but not leastly, you want this to be a greener festival?
Yes, we are going as green as possible this year. We have teamed up with World-Centric, Republic Services, Organicycle, and the City of Grand Rapids to help us bring in the resources. We're going to use compostable, sustainable packaging. So hot tip, if you're coming, if you could reuse your fork, don't throw it away after every meal. Yeah. Keep using that fork. The garbage cans are gone. Do not look for a garbage can. We will have sort stations. You just bring your waste to the sort stations, and they will take care of it for you. They will organize and sort it out as to where it goes. But we're hoping to leave the dumpsters alone and basically recycle or compost everything we can do there. And you can get all the details for all of this on our app. We have an app this year, which is new. So you can check the menus. You can check the schedule. You can sign up to volunteer because we still need some great volunteers. All of it is, there's a map. Everything you need is on the new app for Android and iPhone.
Wonderful. I know there's interactive art by Lee S. Brown. Of course, you mentioned the entertainment, but bottom line, you'll be tasting. Taste of Muskegon is, again, that June 12th through 13th. Tasteofmuskegon.org will get you there as well. Lisa Krause, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Catch up with you, Dr. Randall, with 1L Maurice Jelks. Your latest book is out, My America, Langston Hughes on Democracy, a wonderful book signing this Saturday, 3:30 at Grandma, the Grand Rapids African American Museum. Schuler Books involved. Big introduction to you. Indiana, your place away from home, but we remember you from Calvin, my friend. Good morning.
Well, I started teaching at Calvin, now Calvin University, but then Calvin College, and taught there for a good stint, and then went to the University of Kansas, and then now Indiana University in
yes,
Bloomington.
In Bloomington.
Yes, correct.
My alma mater as well, so yeah. We could digress, but we won't. Dr. Jelks, your name is no stranger to our area, and yet here you are with a new book that you've been working on, Time to Get Together on Saturday. Obviously, anything with America in its title is important for sure for this year. But Langston Hughes, tell me a little bit about your premise.
Well, so My America was an essay that Langston Hughes wrote in the 1940s. And making claims to the United States. Of course, 1940s is Jim Crow America, unfortunately. And so Hughes is writing this essay, stating that how he is the descendants of both people who were enslaved Africans, people who were immigrants interestingly enough, Jewish immigrants, and so he making claims. And his grandmother was an indigenous person from North Carolina. I think they were Lumbees, and so he's making like. I belong to everybody who lives in the United States, and so I thought that'd be a great title for a book. And because I started my career here in Grand Rapids, I remember running across a reading that Langston Hughes gave at Fountain Street Church, he offered. a reading of his poetry. He's known as a poet, but Langston was a children's writer. He composed lyrics with noted singers. That's why Shonda Buchanan is involved. She has a book on Nina Simone, and he wrote a song you can hear by Nina Simone called "The Backlash Blues." So Langston was involved, was a true artist in every sense of the word.
And Professor Shonda Buchanan will be conducting the interview with you this Saturday.
Yeah.
And yes, Langston Hughes, his birth 1902 to 1962.
Actually, his birth is 1901,
oh.
We discovered doing research. You know, the historians are always digging up stuff. So 1901 to 67, actually.
Nice. There you are. Tell me... your book is with us. The front cover, I trust, is him.
Yes.
Yes. And what else will we find in this?
What I do in this book, Shelley, is I wrote this book. I wanted people to read Langston's words himself. So I don't focus so much on the poetry as his essays and speeches. And I put those first, and then I write my own commentary. So it's as though I'm in dialogue with Langston about what he's writing about the time. I try to contextualize it for people, especially young people who may not know what that period looked like. And so have a kind of running dialogue about this long discussion about America, the United States, and our sense of democratic struggle in the United States. One of the real important things, my last two books have been around, centered on democracy, Letters to Martin, Langston Hughes, Meditation on Democracy in Black America. Langston Hughes actually is the source of Martin Luther King Jr. writing I Have a Dream, because I Dream of Freedom is one of Langston's poems, and that gave King stimulation to write I Have a Dream. So he's an important, we don't think of artists all the time as important in terms of poets and writers, but they do foster the imagination for people. And I wanted to say to young people, he's such an interesting life. I mean, he traveled, he dropped out of Columbia, and one of the things, he became a sailor. And he threw his books in the sea, except for one by Walt Whitman, who was a famous American 19th century poet. And he traveled from New York to all the way to Angola in 1923 and back, and then jumped ship, went to Paris, stayed in Paris for about 9 months, and traveled all over the place. So he's a very interesting figure as well.
Thank you, Dr. Randall Jelks, with us sharing his latest, My America, Langston Hughes on Democracy. Are you working on a documentary in tandem?
That's correct. This book actually came out of trying to raise money for a documentary. Since Langston was so international, we have to raise a lot of money. But we started a documentary project. I'm lucky enough to work with my colleague who won an Academy Award, Kevin Wilmot, for the film Black Klansman, for best screenplay adaptation. So Kevin was my colleague at the University of Kansas, and we started this project because Langston's boyhood home was in Lawrence, Kansas. And so
you spent some time in Kansas.
That's
yes.
Correct. That's correct. So Kevin and I started this project, and we're determined to see it through.
Dr. Jelks, how do you envision Saturday at the wonderful Grandma? I was just there for another meeting off of Sheldon there.
Well, yes. Most times book conversations go like this. You invite somebody who has something similar or interesting to ask questions about, and then we open it up to the audience, and hopefully we sell some books. I mean, the idea. But Grand Rapids is home, so I really would like people to come out and read this book. I think it's very, very interesting. And I really want to say this. I'm in the scholarly world, and so many books about democracy and the failure of democracy. But none of those are written from the perspectives of African Americans who, for the last 250 years, have struggled with the problem of unfreedom. And so I really want to, what I write about is how how African Americans have made claims to freedom. And I think that's an interesting conversation to be had with all who would like to come in, hear about it. And read about it, and or soon the book will be on audio, and so or listen to it.
Do you get to voice it, or did you? Hand
I was too busy.
Oh, that's true. Do you will you continue working on the documentary then?
Oh yes, correct. The documentary, we're in full swing, and part of this is, as I open up the book, is to talk about the you know, what I hope for the documentary. I hope it will be more episodic than one documentary.
Yes.
Because I think he has such an incredible life and as an American artist.
Yes. All right. My America, again, you sharing the conversation with Professor Chandra Buchanan, 3:30 at Grandma, Grand Rapids African American Museum and Archives, of course.
And it's on now on Sheldon, and it's a new location.
Yep, wonderful. It is a beautiful venue. I'm sure you'll be sitting on stage in that area and more. How do we find out more information about you?
You can find RandallMauriceJelks.com or my Indiana University website.
Great. Yeah. Going out with a little Nina Simone. What was the name of the...
Backlash Blues.
Backlash Blues. I'm not seeing that, but you're going to hear Central Park Blues.
Oh, anything about
How's
Nina.
That?
Yeah.
Okay.
Feeling Good would be great.
Doctor, let's see if I have Feeling Good. I put a spell on you, little girl. Well, we're going to hear Central Park Blues.
Alrighty.
All right, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you.
Women's Resource Center, the organization capacity to sustain long-term employment pathways, support participant success, and more, has been strengthened. Recently, a grant received thanks to a Grand Rapids Community Foundation. She's almost to a year of leadership doing super work with WRC, Chief Executive Officer. Thanks for you to be in this seat, Dr. Darlene Lee. Good morning.
Good morning, Shelley. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Good that you are here. You've graced our presence before. You'll do it again. How's it feel to almost come upon a year of leadership?
It feels great. It's been an incredible journey. I spent the last 10 months really just on a listening tour, just listening, learning, and building in that order. And what I have learned is that the strength of the women in our community, the women that we serve, the strength of the organization, and opportunities ahead. So it's been a journey, a good journey.
Yes, and obviously being recognized by receiving grants. Before we get into what is happening and a little bit more on your strategic format and more, how would you describe the work of Women's Resource Center?
I would describe the work as essential. Essential to the needs of the women in the community. As we look at the changing times that we're in, where there's a rising cost of housing, transportation, and women are impacted in every area of their lives financially. So our work becomes that much more important when we're preparing women for economic sustainability.
If you can follow up with that, again, just the basics, that is one of your missions, is you work with women to employ.
Absolutely. So our mission is to help women achieve purpose, fulfillment, and financial stability through meaningful employment. And I am focusing really on that stability part, that financial stability part, as we move forward, again, because of what's happening in our community or in economically in our community. So it's very important for us to really hone in on that mission. And we hone in on that mission through our two programs. One is our Empower program. That program is for unemployed, underemployed, underserved, and women in career transition. And then our New Beginnings program, that program is for women who are justice involved. We go into Kent County Jail 90 days pre-release, and we work with them on employability skills, career coaching, self-esteem, self-confidence, and really all roads lead to workforce development and employment with both of those programs.
Thank you. Where are you physically located?
We are located at 816 Madison Avenue Southeast, right here in Grand Rapids.
Dr. Lee, let's get into the recent receiving of a $300,000 in grant funding from the Grand Rapids Community Foundation. Talk about this.
Oh, absolutely. We are incredibly grateful to the Grand Rapids Community Foundation for this transformational investment into the Women's Resource Center. It really helps underscore the important work that we do, our legacy in the community for more than 50-plus years. And it underscores that, and it also highlights the importance of our continued work. So their investment just shows us that that women need our services, the community needs our services, and I'm really excited that the community has come together to support us. So not only has the Grand Rapids Community Foundation come together to support us, but numerous other organizations have come together. More than 27 corporations and foundations have supported us over the last year, and not including in the hundreds of individuals. And what's really striking is wherever I go, someone always has a connection to the Women's Resource Center, which speaks to its impact.
Yes. Will this recent grant be earmarked specifically for services?
Yes, so it is earmarked for the services in both of our programs. Again, those career readiness services. Those we do mock interviewing with participants, resume writing. We're also moving in a different direction, I should say, in terms of our strategic plan. We have five focus areas that we are focusing on. And they include, the first area is we're looking to expand pathways to employment by connecting women to more workforce training, more career coaching, and opportunities that lead to long-term success. The second area is we're going to continue strengthening partnerships with employers, educational institutions, and community organizations to create clear pathways from training to employment, advancement, and economic sustainability.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. So that's one. Mm-hmm. That's two. Mm-hmm. Any other highlights?
Oh, yeah. So third, we are elevating women's voices. We're going to be sharing their stories. As last year, we shared the She's the Why, and we shared women's stories there, increasing visibility, mm-hmm. helping our community better understand the barriers women face while advocating for systems that support women and their families. The fourth area is we are investing in organizational strength by building high-performing, mission-driven organization with people, systems, and the culture necessary to sustain and grow our impact. And lastly, we are ensuring long-term sustainability by diversifying our resources, strengthening the financial foundation that's needed to serve not only women today, but for the long-term generations to come.
Yes. Dr. Darlene Lee with us, Chief Executive Officer, Women's Resource Center. Again, a grant received, a strategic opportunity to help with the career pathway, and certainly much, much more. What else is important we know, Dr. Lee, as you come to a year under your belt?
What's important to know is that women are still in need. We do have a wait list, and where we are right now is women come into the Women's Resource Center.
Can actually come and knock on, do they need an appointment, or may I just knock on their door?
So they come, knock on the door, but then they do need an appointment. And they understand that we are the resource, and I really call ourselves a resource hub where women can come and actually get what they need. Sometimes although we focus on employability, yes, we also help women gain self-esteem, self-confidence in the tools that they need to exceed in the workplace. Mm-hmm. So we have our, I share a little bit about our New Beginnings and our Empower program, but we also have an incredible business boutique that women come into the business boutique, and a dedicated volunteer helps them select an outfit for an interview so that they can go to that job interview feeling confident and they're dressed to impress.
Yes. Do you need the community to step up for any donations or ways to make that even a bigger and better experience?
Absolutely. We're always needing more donations, more funding, more donations, and more volunteers, because our work really is built on volunteers. We have incredible volunteers who work in our boutique, incredible volunteers who support us. Sometimes they come, they're sitting at the receptionist desk. They're assisting with mock interviewing, too. They're assisting with resume writing. We have workshops around computer workshops, other kinds of workshop as they come available, as our participants let us know what they're in need of.
If anybody needs practice for a radio interview,
we'll bring them in.
That's right. Dr. Lee, congratulations. Again, I know grants are nice to receive, as are donations from your community as well, to keep the lights on as well. Mm-hmm. What do you, what's your inspiring leave us message on behalf of receiving a grant and moving forward into your next year?
Well, so my inspiring leave us message is...
Not expiring.
Inspiring. Inspiring and motivational.
Yes.
We had talked before the interview started about our career pathways. Yes. Just let me share one of those. So, for example, one of the pathways is healthcare. And oftentimes our participants have a challenge of thinking it's going to take too long to achieve what it is they want to achieve. So they might give up. So what we have done is created a pathway that allows them to visually see how they can get from point A to B. For example, healthcare. A participant could get a CNA license in 2 to 4 weeks, make somewhere between $15 to $20 an hour. From there, they can become a phlebotomist. That takes 10 weeks, make somewhere between $20 and $22 an hour. Those two are a living wage, but then they can become an LPN. That takes a year. Then they make anywhere from $28 on up. And now we're hitting our mission, which is stability wage. And then they can become an RN. That takes 2 years. And from there, they're making somewhere between $35 and up, $50 if they're traveling. And now we're not only at stability wage, but we are at the place where we can build wealth.
Thank you for putting that into a very basic perspective, and yet that's oftentimes what we need, is help me along the journey. Dr. Darlene Lee, we find you at grwrc.org. Yes?
Absolutely.
Yes, look up Dr. Darlene Lee and the wonderful team and board that you have. Congratulations on the grant.
Thank you.
See you around.
Yep, thanks,
Kim. Let's talk with a Michigan mother, a foster parent, an author who's opened her home to 11 domestic and refugee foster kids over the past 8 years. I wonder if that number has even grown since my reading. Laura Boonstra on the line. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
How are the stats? Are you good with 11 domestic and refugee foster kids?
That's our number.
Well, in a nutshell, thank you for that. And of course, you're here to talk about it because your new book, Our Family is Not a Tree, shares the inspiring story of your family's journey in refugee foster care. And of course, thanks to Samaritas hosting a book event for us this Sunday afternoon. Noon, we'll get right back to that. When did you know that fostering would become part of your family, Laura Boonstra?
You know, when I was a kid, I thought we would probably open our home in some way. I didn't know if that meant fostering or adopting. We have two biological children who are now 14 and 16. And when they were maybe 2 and 4, we attended an orientation for domestic foster care, thinking maybe it's the time, maybe this is the way to serve. And it just didn't feel right. We didn't quite have the right supports in place. And so we kind of put that on the back burner. And then several years later, a friend from church was getting licensed with Samaritas to host a teen in her home through their independent living program. And, you know, they were good friends, but we also knew they were just regular people. And so seeing them step forward made it feel like maybe we could do it too. And so that was 8 years ago now. And then, yeah, we've cared for 11 children since that time.
Yes. Let's bring the work of Samaritas into the conversation. We know one of Michigan's largest foster care and refugee resettlement agencies. Talk to me a little bit about how you knew that Samaritas would be important to work with.
You know, it was more of a just that the need was there and that they happened to be the people that we sort of, I guess, that God brought into our circle at the time that we were feeling ready to step into something. We didn't necessarily, you know, seek them out. We sort of said, oh, I think we're ready for something. And they were just right there. And there was this clear need. There are 10,000 total youth in care currently in Michigan. That's in all of kids in foster care. 3,000 of those are in non-relative licensed homes. So what we typically think of foster homes, where it's not someone who's related to the child. And several hundreds of those kids are refugees in refugee foster care. And so Samaritas really has just a huge part in caring for these kids across the state. And then working with their agency has just been a wonderful support. They are truly people who see kids for who they are, like see them first as children and not necessarily as, you know, the trauma that they've endured or the things that they've experienced, but who really care about them. So working with them really has felt like we have partners in caring for these children.
The title of your book is striking. Our family is not a tree. What does that mean? And what's the core theme of your book?
So that title is actually based on a poem that I wrote just in thinking about our family. We have two biological sons. We have two children who were in our care as refugees. And while refugee teens need families, they are often not able to be adopted. And so they still need families to commit to them. Long-term families age out of care, but they don't necessarily age out of needing a family. And so we have two children who are still a part of our family, although not legally. And then we also have a daughter who was adopted through domestic foster care. We had sort of, there was a pause in a program that we were doing with Samaritas, and there was a need for this child. And so we were fostered her for a little while and eventually adopted her. And so when I think about our family, you know, we often talk about family trees, but family trees kind of branch in predictable ways, and they all come from the same place. And our family has just grown in such a way that, you know, we're not only grafted with the children who have come into our home, but we're truly connected with their first families also. Our youngest daughter's family is a part of our life, too. We see her grandmother regularly, and she's become like a grandmother to all of our children. And our oldest children from Guatemala, we're connected to their family that is still in Guatemala. And so it really felt like we're not necessarily a family tree like you typically think about that. And honeybees, if you ever see them, they kind of just twist together in this way that they just kind of grow from all over the place and they support each other. And that just felt like a better picture for what our family looks like. We're all just sort of, we've come from different places and we're all twisting together and we've become this family unit supporting each other.
And you do gather this Sunday for a reading, a discussion of your new book. Talk to me a little bit more about the participation come Sunday.
Yeah, so this Sunday we'll be at Trinity Lutheran Church in Grand Rapids. Sunday, June 7th from 1 to 3 p.m. I'll be there with Samaritas. It's a opportunity to share our family's story, but truly just as a jumping off point to help people see the kids, the real faces and names behind the numbers when we think about refugee foster care. Samaritas has done incredible work here in the community, but also all across Michigan in caring for children, reunifying children, supporting children as they launch off to independence. And so it's just an opportunity for the community to see what Samaritas is doing, to see the need, and hopefully to see themselves in that story and see ways that they can step in. Obviously, foster families are needed. You know, I shared those numbers. Samaritas has capacity for probably 20 more kids. kids that they could care for if they had foster families. The only piece that they're missing is the families and the homes to ready to step in and support a child. And so we're really hoping to just share the need and help people see ways that they might step in to support refugees here in our community.
Thank you for that, especially foster parents for older kids and young refugees. So putting you on the spot, I know you've had the question before. What would you say to someone listening who thinks they aren't qualified to take in a teen or a refugee youth, Laura?
Yeah, I think especially for someone who's never had teens themselves, it can feel kind of intimidating. We actually stepped in when our children were 7 and 9 years old. And so we had never parented a teen. And then our first placement was a 19-year-old girl from Guatemala. And she absolutely became a part of our family. She's like a daughter to us. She continues to be a part of our lives. But it feels sometimes like it takes extra special people to be foster parents. And I think people like to say, wow, like you're so special. We hear that a lot. But it truly just takes ordinary, average people willing to open their homes and open their lives to kids, willing to, you know, maybe have a flexible schedule or utilize Google Translate. But there's absolutely support along the way from Samaritas for families opening their homes. We have friends who are foster parents who are retired people in their 60s and 70s, and we ourselves, you know, are fostering with children in our home. We have friends who are young single people who are fostering. And so it really, there's no particular family shape or size or style that could, you know, is an ideal foster family. It really takes all types. And I would say you don't have to see the whole road ahead of you. We have just seen the next step and felt like we were called into this thing, and we took one step and it just felt like God has led us again and again and has paved the way. So even if you can't see the whole path, just take the next step in front of you and see where God is leading you.
Thank you for that. We know Samaritas.org, certainly the website for more information. How do we find out more about you and your new book, Our Family is Not a Tree?
Yeah, it's available online on Amazon or through Barnes & Noble or through the publisher Westbow Press.
And, of course, seeing you this Sunday, 1 to 3, at Trinity Lutheran Church in Grand Rapids, a book event for you to share your incredible family story. Keep up the great work, and may that number rise for you. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Eosinophilic esophagitis, let's call it EOE, one of the fastest growing digestive diseases in the U.S. It affects an estimated 1 in 700 people. We want to talk about it. It remains undiagnosed. So we talk about it with you as food should not hurt. So know the signs. Dr. Evan Dellen, good morning to you to explain.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Of course, you're a professor of medicine and adjunct professor of epidemiology at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine in Chapel Hill. You used to live in Durham. Wonderful land you have, and thank you for your treatment to many. What is this EOE?
Yeah, EOE, or eosinophilic esophagitis, it's a chronic condition, a lifelong condition, that is an allergic condition of the esophagus. And you could think about it almost as asthma of the esophagus or eczema of the esophagus. And what happens is allergy cells, one of which is the eosinophil, build up abnormally in the esophagus. And that causes a lot of swelling and irritation and ultimately scar tissue. And because of that, it causes a number of symptoms and can make swallowing difficult or painful. And as you mentioned, it is one of the fastest growing digestive diseases. We do see it now in about 1 in 700 people, where a decade or two ago, we really thought it was a rare disease. And so I really appreciate the efforts in raising awareness today.
Yes. Why the awareness of it increasing now?
Well, I think, you know, many allergic conditions are increasing, and EOE is one of them, but it's really rapidly rising, even more so than other allergy things. And what we're finding is that despite this increase, many patients have trouble getting diagnosed. The condition may be missed or even misdiagnosed. And part of that is because the symptoms can overlap with more common conditions like reflux. And patients also may adapt their eating habits. They may become very careful with their eating and minimize the symptoms. And that actually prevents them from going to a provider and telling them that they're having troubles.
Dr. Dellen, what would be a key warning sign or two we should be looking for?
Sure. Well, in adolescents and adult patients, trouble swallowing is really the main thing. And people may perceive that as food getting stuck or hanging up or a choking sensation when eating, or just food going down slowly. And none of those are normal. I think what happens with people is that they may misinterpret that and think that, oh, I just ate too fast, or food was overcooked, or I was distracted and didn't chew well. But it's really abnormal to have something stick like that. And what happens is people actually adapt to those symptoms almost subconsciously. They may eat more carefully, chew more thoroughly, even avoid foods that cause the sticking sensation. And because of that, it may be 5 years or more until they actually present and get diagnosed. And what happens sometimes is they'll present with a food impaction. That's where food is stuck in the esophagus, and it doesn't go up and down, and it requires emergency care. Now, in children, though, the symptoms are more tricky because they're nonspecific, and so that could include things like abdominal pain, vomiting, regurgitation, poor growth, problems with weight gain, and even feeding difficulties or just being a picky eater. And so it's really up to, you know, a pediatric GI specialist to kind of sort through those issues and make the diagnosis. And then, as you might imagine, because these symptoms are so much related to food and eating, and there's so many social interactions around food, a lot of people become very anxious around eating and worrying what happens if symptoms occur during a work meeting or school, and that causes a lot of distress.
Does this is this under the category of a chronic disease? Can it be fixed?
So it is a chronic disease, and right now we don't have any cure, but we do have lots of effective treatments. And that's another reason that if people have these symptoms, they should reach out to their provider, because even though you can't grow out of it or it can't be cured right now, people can have a really nice improvement with treatments.
And early intervention key?
It is. We think that identifying it early and not having this long delay in diagnosis will decrease complications, particularly things like developing scar tissue and blockages of the esophagus or having trouble with nutrition and growth.
And May 22nd is actually a day that's dedicated to this.
It is, yeah. It's World EOE Day, and we're trying to, you know, raise the awareness. So if people think they have symptoms, they can talk to their providers about it. Sometimes, actually, it's the family member who might recognize the symptoms in one of their, other family members.
And lastly, just an anatomy lesson. Remind me of the role of our esophagus.
Sure. So the esophagus is a swallowing tube. So it connects the mouth to the stomach, and it protects us from food going down. It has a nice resilient lining, and it has muscle function too, so it will push food down from your mouth into your stomach. And normally it's a nice soft kind of compliant tube, and in EOE, because it becomes inflamed and swollen and stiff, that's where really a lot of the symptoms come from.
So what's our best source of information, please?
Yeah, so if you want to learn more, you can reach out to some of the GI support societies, including the American Gastroenterological Association, or APFED, the American Partnership for Eosinophilic Disorders. If you go to APFED.org, it's APFED.org/EOE Day, you'll see lots of resources there.
And I'm going back to my medical terminology. Eosin means what?
So eosin is actually a type of stain that we use under the microscope. It's kind of a pinkish magenta stain, and it highlights these cells. And so they're called eosinophils, and it actually means the cells uptake that stain very readily. And they're very easy to see on biopsies and tissue samples of the esophagus, and that's how we make the diagnosis. So we're looking for those eosinophil cells.
Thank you for you and the good work you do giving back to your students and, of course, talking about this important topic. Thank you, Dr. Evan Dellen. You take care.
Thanks so much for having me.